First Peter 2, verse 18, we see is addressed to servants, slaves, laborers. We're told to be subject to our masters with all fear. In other words, fear that is fitting, fear at all times and to all proper degrees, showing reverence and respect to them as put over us by God, and having the right to expect that kind of honor from those who are under them. Now, the next question is, all right, that's all right and good if you have a master who is somewhat fair and decent and treats you right. What happens should you be placed under someone who is a complete tyrant, who is cruel and abusive, who mistreats you, has no sense of justice whatsoever, and it's impossible to work for? You certainly can't expect me to fear that kind of man, can you? Well, this excuse is removed by Peter when he says, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the froward. So in other words, the duty of servants to be subject to their own masters with all fear is to be carried out by servants regardless of the character and conduct of their master. That's not a consideration that we base our duty on. See what I'm saying? You don't even consider what kind of man is it as far as do I give him this obedience and respect. Peter says, not only to the good and gentle. Now they're easy to serve. But also, in the same way, even to the froward. Now Peter, in this verse, seems to be speaking of unsaved masters. It's probably possible that there was the occasional Christian master. We know that was the case. Paul wrote to at least one, Philemon. You have Paul giving directions to Christian masters. But in this particular circumstance, whoever Peter's writing to, you know, if you are scattered and dispersed because of your faith into strange areas, you don't normally get established to where you are in a position to have a business or own slaves and be set up and established. So probably he's talking of unsaved masters, and he breaks them down into two different categories based upon their varying temperaments and methods of handling their slaves. Now even in the unsaved world, you're going to find a lot of variation, aren't you? Not everyone is as cruel and crass and mean and nasty as can be. You find some real nice people out there, lost, but yet in a lot of ways they have some very positive characteristics. They're not Christians, but they may be moral and have some consideration for doing what's right. Now, the first one Peter mentions are the good, the kind, benevolent, and caring master. And then he's also a gentle master. And that would mean the yielding, mild, patient, fair, considerate, humane, reasonable, forbearing, and equitable master. How many bosses you had like that? Well, once in a while you find one. You find the word used in Acts 24, verse 5. I'm sorry, verse 4. Notwithstanding that I be not further tedious unto thee, I pray thee that thou wouldst hear us of thy clemency a few words. You know, you're very patient and gentle and understanding. So will you hear me out here as I tell you why this Paul ought to have his head cut off? Which is basically, you know, this guy is an orator and he's also a flatterer. You know, he says, oh, most noble Felix, You know, by you we have this great quietness. You do very worthy deeds to this nation by thy great providence. And we accept it always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness. Boy, you can just taste the syrup flowing all over the place. And all he's trying to do is butter him up to get what he wants. So, you know, I don't want to cause you any more time and trouble. So show some clemency in hearing my plea. And he tells what a rotten, no good criminal Paul is, so they can get him killed. All right, so here you have masters who were kind and considerate of their servants and who cared for their welfare. And that's nice to have a boss like that, isn't it? That's very pleasant. We love working for someone like that. I could even try to do a good job for a boss like that and treat him fairly decent in return. You know the old saying, give back what you get, you know. You do me good, I'll do you good. Isn't that how it works? Well, not if you're a Christian. He says you should be subject not only to your good and gentle masters, but also to the froward. Now that word means those who are bent, crooked, contorted, perverse, untoward. They're self-willed, mean, nasty, and cruel masters. A master who was cross, exacting, and harsh, and impossible to deal with. You just couldn't please them. You ever had someone like that? No matter what you did, it was wrong. And when you did that, they wanted you to do something else. And what you did do, you know, didn't satisfy them. The word in the Old Testament, Proverbs 2:15, someone want to read that? Proverbs 2:15? All right, Robin. And then Deuteronomy 32:5. Okay, Jordan. Proverbs 2 is a description of the evil man that speaks froward things. Verse 15. Right, they follow crooked paths, and they're froward in the course of going down those paths. Deuteronomy 32:5. A perverse and crooked generation. Paul quotes that in the book of Philippians, and he tells us we're to be, you know, gentle and harmless and sincere and shine as lights in, you know, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, which is the state of man because of sin, in the midst of an unsaved world who is depraved. All right, now, if you had a master who was froward, it was common that they would think of their slaves as mere property that were to be used for personal gain and used up. You know, get as much out of them as you can, no matter how much it, you know, hurt them to give that to you. And so they had no true concern for their slaves' well-being other than what would make them more productive and profitable. I was only do for you what will enable you to do more work for me. I don't care about your condition or your comfort or your happiness. I guess I'll have to feed you even though it costs me something, because if you don't eat, you don't have the strength to work for me. You know, that kind of idea. Only do it because I'll get something back for it. Now, because of the nature of the slave system, you know, men were put in the category of property, animals, and then because of the sinful heart of man, you know, masters were sinners, and they tended to express that in their dealings with their slaves. The latter kind of masters, the froward masters, were probably much more numerous and common than the former kind, the kind and gentle. So what was a slave's only consideration? What God required them to do, not what their masters deserved. You know, God will deal with the master. He'll give them their due. All they got, I have to worry about is, what does God tell me I should do? All right? Now, what Peter does is he's going to point out that it was especially pleasing to God when the slaves obeyed froward masters under adverse circumstances, and where their treatment would try to tempt them to do just the opposite. As I say, when we're abused and misused, we become peevish. You know, we become depressed. We become whiny and defensive. And all we can think of is, I don't want to do anything for that guy if he's going to treat me like that. And as a matter of fact, if I could, I'd get back to him and give him a little bit of his own. And so there's always this tendency to feel like I'm justified if I don't do my job as I should. Why should a slave obey such a master and show him respect? Verse 19 says, for, which is the word because. This is why, and it's given in the form of a motive. A motive for obeying froward masters. Not because it was easy, not because they enjoyed doing so, not because it was the proper return, you know, if you go by an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, but only because it was pleasing to God. And I guarantee you, when you're put in that position, your sinful flesh is going to rear up and it's going to react if you don't keep it under control. And your carnal reasoning is going to give you every excuse why you should do this guy dirty. That's the natural response. We're trying to look at the Christian response. What has God put in us by His Spirit? For this, or which immediately follows, is thankworthy. That's a different word, thankworthy. You know what word it is? In the Greek it's charis. And that's the word that's usually translated grace. This is grace. Ah, what's grace? Undeserved favor, right? How did God treat us when we were wicked and ornery and mean and disobedient? Well, how should we treat a froward master? With grace. Here it's used in the sense of thanks. And that's often a mean, you know, you ever say grace at the table, what are you saying? Thanks. You know, you're recognizing that everything you have comes from God, and it's His free gift to you, undeserved, out of His goodness, and you want to express your gratitude for that. And even the gratitude is grace. We wouldn't thank God if it wasn't His work in our hearts. Luke 6, 32, 33. Who'd like to read that? Luke 6, 32. All right, Zach. Luke 6, 32 and 33.
All right.
Even a sinner will sometimes respond to kind treatment in like. Of course, if you have your King James, it says, if you do good to them which do good to you, what thank have ye? For sinners also do even the same. If you lend to them of whom you hope to receive, what thank have ye? That's the word I was looking for, thank. For sinners also lend to sinners to receive as much. Now, in the parallel passages, Matthew 5:46, I want to read that. In Matthew 5:46, Elizabeth. And then, Paul, if you want to read 6:35 then, Luke 6:35. You find where one place says thanks, the other place says, it gives the idea of reward. Matthew 5:46 first. All right, what reward? One place said what thank, here what reward. How about Luke 6:35? All right, so again, the idea of a reward from God for repaying evil with good, which is what we're called to do. All right, now, the idea here is that it's a result of God's grace that we're allowed to suffer for Christ. You remember Philippians says, unto you it is given. That word is there, it's the good gift of God's grace to you, not only to believe on Christ, but also to suffer for His sake. I believe that's Philippians 1:29. So in other words, it's a grace that you're able to suffer for Christ. And then it's by God's grace that we can bear our sufferings cheerfully and patiently and show love to those who cause us suffering. And then, finally, God promises us that He will reward us for our faithfulness to Him in this way. And yet, it's a reward in grace. See, He gives us the grace to suffer. He gives us the grace to suffer in the right way. And then He gives us a reward for that, even though it was His grace that enabled all that to happen. And so, even the reward is a reward of grace, not something we earned or deserved. And we display God's grace in our lives when we are enabled by Him to suffer unjustly in a meek manner. That shows grace. You know, when you get mad and you spit and kick and yell and fight, that's not grace. That's flesh. We're going to find out later, how did Christ respond to that kind of treatment? Graciously. Very graciously. We'll see what that is. So, it's grace or favor. It's praiseworthy and commendable. It's acceptable to and approved by God. And it finds His approbation when we bear injuries. Let's see a couple of places where this concept of something being grace before God. Genesis 6:8. Okay, Steve. Genesis 32:5. Joel. Luke 1:30. Daniel. Genesis 6:8.
But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord.
All right. Noah found favor in God's sight. God graced Noah. And it's the same when we are bearing injuries this way. If we find grace in God's eyes or His favor and acceptance. Genesis 32:5.
And
Right, may I be accepted in your sight, or may you show me your favor. May I be pleasing to you. Luke 1:30. Found favor with God. God will favorably recognize and reward those servants who do their duty. And it's especially pleasing to Him when they do it under those circumstances. In other words, you have a greater opportunity to manifest God's grace when you have a froward master than when you have one that's kind and gentle. So look at it as an opportunity. And it'll also be a means of growth for us. Because we need grace to do that, more grace than normal. Ephesians 6, here has the idea of reward. Verses 5 to 8, servants, be obedient to them that are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling and singleness of your heart as unto Christ, not with eye service as men pleasers, but as the servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart. With goodwill, doing service as to the Lord and not to men. Why? Knowing, or here's something you can be assured of and be aware of even as you do this, that whatsoever good thing any man doeth, the same shall he receive of the Lord, whether he be bond or free. All right, God is not unrighteous to forget your service that you do unto His name, and He will reward it. And that's really part of the idea of this is thankworthy, something God promises a reward of grace to. So here it was a great encouragement to slaves to know that their lowly service, you know, a slave was a nothing, and their bearing of harsh treatment, because that's how slaves are normally treated, this was seen by God. God noticed it. He recorded it. It was pleasing to Him. You know, it was a means of manifesting His grace, and it would not lose its reward. Now, that lifts what the world looks at as a miserable bondage in a whole new category and makes it a great and important service unto God, a sacred thing. And that's the great thing about Christianity. Whatever you're doing, according to the will of God, is a service to Him. He looks on with favor, and He notices it, and it has a big part in His overall kingdom and purpose. And it's making its mark for Him in the world. And someday He'll show His favor on it, especially in the last day when He comes to reward every man according to his works. All right, what's thankworthy? If a man... All right, here's a supposed situation. If a man for conscience toward God endure grief, suffering wrongfully. Notice, it's not just a matter of being mistreated. Well, if I'm mistreated, I'll get a reward. No. If you're mistreated as a result of having a conscience toward God, and if your suffering is not brought on by anything you do wrong, or you are suffering unjustly for Christ's sake. Now the word conscience, it means a knowing with. And it speaks of a man's self-knowledge or a moral self-awareness. You know, a man has a unique ability, as a rational being, he knows that he knows. And he knows what he knows, and he knows himself, and what he is aware of, his own self-knowledge. And conscience, when you think of it as a moral faculty, it's a reflex action of the mind regarding an innate knowledge of right and wrong, which God has placed within us, and the relation of that knowledge to our moral state and actions. In other words, I can have a basic concept of right and wrong that God has put within me as a creature made in His image. I can look at what my condition, my actual state, and then also at my behavior, my character and conduct, and I can compare the two, and then my conscience will either approve or disapprove. That's what a conscience is all about. Very important part of man's nature that God has given us as morally responsible creatures. Romans 2, 14 and 15 talks about Gentiles who've never seen God's written law as contained in the Scriptures. Yet they do the things that God's law requires, or avoid the things that God's law forbids. How do you account for that? Because God has given every man a knowledge of right and wrong. Verse 14, for when the Gentiles, which have not the law, do by nature the things contained in the law, notice, they're doing what the law requires by their nature, or by an innate knowledge. These having not the law are a law unto themselves. Because they can't claim to have no knowledge of right and wrong. And their own law will condemn them. Their own conscience will accuse them and damn them in the end because they knew better when they did the things they did wrong. Which show the work of the law written in their hearts. Now that's not in the new birth, under the new covenant, God writes His law in our minds and hearts. This is talking about the original writing that came by the fact that man was made in the image of God as a moral creature and had created with him knowledge of right and wrong. He was created in righteousness. And that's to a great degree been lost and defaced and yet not eradicated. Men still have, you know, the writing is pretty blurred, but there are still some faint etches of right and wrong in every man's soul. Not that they can do right, but they can know right. Outwardly, they may try to form their lives by what their conscience tells them. You know, let your conscience be your guide, but never sufficiently to please God or to gain any favor or merit with Him. Their own conscience will tell them that they have fallen short. But anyway, they have this work of the law written in their hearts. Notice, it doesn't say the law is written in their hearts, the work of the law. Some effects of the law that was originally with us. Their conscience also bearing witness. Right? The conscience is meant to be a faculty of moral discrimination, which is supposed to be an inward monitor telling us right and wrong based on God's law. And their thoughts, the meanwhile, accusing or else excusing one another. In other words, our self-knowledge telling us either we've followed what we know is right or we've violated it. And that's an explanation why in every culture and people, no matter how far removed or how backward and primitive, there's a basic moral code of right and wrong that holds true universally. And that's because men are made in the image of God, whoever they are, wherever they are. And so that work of the law in their hearts and the conscience He's given us still witnesses to God's moral standards. So in Peter it means a consciousness of God or an awareness of His presence and of our duty to Him. And this consciousness, notice we have a conscience, which is an inward witness to God, and it gives us a consciousness of God and of our accountability to Him and of what He requires of us. And then this consciousness of God makes the Christian to be conscientious or careful to do God's will and to avoid sin. And of course, we have more than just conscience. We have the restored nature, the law of God written in our minds and hearts. And we also have the Holy Spirit bearing witness with our conscience. You know, the conscience is not a perfect guide. It's often misinformed It's often it's prejudice, and it's often in many areas seared, and so we can't just go entirely by our conscience. Okay, so what Peter's saying is, our being mindful of God, right, a conscience toward God, it motivates us to live so as to please God more than man or even more than ourselves. And now Peter tells us what it is that the slave does out of conscience toward God in order to please him. He endures grief. The word to endure means to undergo or to bear. You find it in 1 Corinthians 10:13. Remember where he says, "No temptation has taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation make the way to escape, that you may be able to bear it." Notice, when he says to make the way to escape, that does not necessarily mean we get out of the temptation because of the fact he says we can bear it. In other words, the escape is God giving us the grace and enablement to go through it. 2 Timothy 3:11, that's another place where that word is used. Paul is talking about his persecution, afflictions, which came unto him at Antioch, at Iconium, at Lystra. What persecutions I endured, there's the word, but out of them all the Lord delivered me. It means to go through or experience. We're going to have to go through or experience what? Griefs. And that word means troubles, vexations, or causes of grief and distress. Heaviness, sorrow, pain of body or mind. Have any of those lately? We often say, good grief. I guess we like it. Well, otherwise, why say it's good? Well, it is good if it's suffered for conscience toward God. You see the word in Hebrews 12:11. It says there, "Now, no chastening, for the present seemeth to be joyous, but grievous." Your mom and dad did not take you out in the woodshed to make you feel good. It's grievous. It hurts. It's painful. But it's good. It's necessary and beneficial. Because afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to them which are exercised thereby. So some people get their exercise in different ways. We are exercised in our souls by the trials that God brings to us in His chastening. And they're hard. They hurt. But they develop Christian character. So these Christian servants were in great difficulty. They're enduring griefs. And now Peter explains why these servants were enduring griefs. It seems that they were being owned by froward, unbelieving, and cruel masters who were treating them very harshly. Not only were they suffering at the hand of these masters, but they were suffering unjustly. Their ill treatment was undeserved. They had done nothing wrong. Matter of fact, they had done only good. And yet their heathen masters were punishing them. Oh, that's hard. That is hard. I mean, we think, if I didn't anything wrong and I'm being treated this way, I've got every right to be mad, to be upset, to argue, to complain, to try to get out of it. I mean, if I did something wrong, well, I guess I'll take it on the chin because I deserve it. I mean, I got it coming. I can handle that. But if I didn't do it wrong, then I know one's going to do this to me. I'm not going to let them get away with it. I'll make sure they know I don't like it. No, see, Peter's arguing just the opposite. If you did wrong, big deal if you take that well, because you deserve it anyway. But if you do right and suffer, now we're talking about something that's worthwhile, something that's grace. Remember how James 5:6 says the believers were often treated? You have condemned and killed who? The just. Not the criminal, not the evildoer, the just, the righteous. And he doth not resist you. He doesn't fight back. He doesn't defend himself. He doesn't argue. He try to maintain his rights. Usually, we become angry or sullen if we're mistreated unjustly and through no fault of our own. Boy, this, what a bum deal. Who does he think he is? You know, I didn't do anything. Why? He had no right to treat me like that. I'm not going to put up with this. I'm not going to let him do this to me. I see it yelled at work all the time. You're not assertive enough. You know, you let them do whatever they want to you. You don't say anything. You know, why do you let them walk all over you like that? You know, you got to stand up and for your rights. And so what? That's what I always thought. But anyway, we usually feel that our griefs are intolerable if we did nothing to deserve them. Well, I'll tell you what. Anything we suffer in this world is less than what we deserve. We're sinners. Anything short of hell is a blessing. I don't care what happens. Anything outside of hell is God's mercy. Well, let's not get this chip on our shoulder that we don't deserve to be mistreated. If someone does that, oh, you know, woe is them, or woe is us. What's Peter doing? He's encouraging these slaves. He's telling them that God looked with favor upon them and promised to reward them for suffering unjustly for his sake. Are you willing to go through this for me? God says, you care enough about your testimony for me that you're willing to forget about your feelings and your rights and what you feel you have coming to you, and say, well, Lord, if this is what you send my way, I'll accept it as from you, and I will take it by your grace gladly and seek to honor you by showing a cheerful attitude, being humble and meek and patient, and going about my duties just as much as if the guy was patting me on the back and giving me a special reward. That's Christianity, and that's what we need to strive for. Not that we can do it, but that's what we need to look for grace to do from God. As a matter of fact, Peter's saying that they should prefer to suffer in this way and not fall prey to temper and impatience, but see this as an opportunity to manifest God's grace. In other words, this is God saying to you, all right, my child, let's show this world and that mean, rotten, ornery master of yours what God's grace is really like and what it can do and how it's real in your life. Because if you act otherwise, you have completely disobeyed God, lost your opportunity, and failed to do your duty. And hurt your master's opportunity of coming to Christ. Maybe your master needs to see God's grace in his slave when he does that to him before he'll ever be convinced of the reality of Christianity and his need for the Lord and his forgiveness. We're saved by grace. So show forth grace in the name of Christ. You know, be a testimony for him by acting as he acted in those circumstances and as he requires us to act, to see if God won't show his grace to the very one who's treating you that way. God says thank you. Almost as if it was us, our doing, or as if we deserved it. If, because of our conscience toward God, notice, what has to be the overruling consideration? My feelings, or my comfort, or my sense of right and wrong? No, my conscience toward God. Well, what will my conscience toward God enable me to do? To endure grief. Not to cause grief. Not to fight grief, endure it. How? Suffering wrongfully. You see what I'm saying? You can, in a good conscience before God, suffer unjustly for His sake, and when you do, that is grace. And, hey, whoever said the Christian calling was easy, it's a high calling, and I'd say a hard calling, but I'd rather say impossible. With men it's impossible, but not with God, for with God all things are possible, including the ability to endure grief, suffering wrongfully. In conscience toward God, looking more for His smile of approval and promise of reward than for my master's or my boss's fairness and kindness and gentleness. So, there's the encouragement. Now, slaves didn't have anywhere to go, anything to appeal to, or any earthly means of relief. So he says, you're going to go through it, and here's how you can do it in a Christian manner and in a way that honors God and will further His cause in the world. And that applies to us as well. We're going to stop.